WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We open Fresh Air today with Tonsillectomy featuring Boyd Rayburn and his orchestra. 3 weeks ago, Nicaraguans shot down a plane flying a Contra supply mission. They've put crew member Eugene Hassenfuss on trial. The mission has raised questions about CIA and private backing of the Contras. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll hear from former Contra leader Edgar Chamorro, who now opposes CIA funding of the Contras. And we'll hear from Javier Aguayo, a spokesperson for the Contras. The Philadelphia Get to Know Us campaign has a new set of TV spots, which just started airing on local TV stations. My guest is Garrett Brown, who directed the original Get to Know Us spots as well as the new ones. He also served on the committee that created them. He's produced several well-known ad campaigns. His best-known radio and TV commercials are the ones he co-stars in, like the ads for Molson's, in which you hear him using the beer as an angle to flirt with a woman. Advertising is just one part of his career. He's a freelance director and cinematographer. In the film world, he was honored with an Academy Award for his invention, the Steadicam, which is a portable camera that doesn't jiggle as the cameraman moves. His latest invention, the Skycam, can fly a couple of hundred feet in the air to shoot bird's-eye views. He's been a cameraman on about 200 films, including The Shining, Revenge of the Jedi, and Rocky. Garrett Brown, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry.
I want to spend the first part of our interview talking about the Get to Know Us campaign. And the new commercials just started to air, so I'm sure some of our listeners have seen them and others have not. So let me ask you to describe the focus of the second campaign.
Well, there was a feeling the first time around that the one aspect of life in Philly that was missing was a look at our nightlife. And I know over the years that some people think that our nightlife is missing in general. I don't happen to feel that way. I mean, night in a city is as exciting as a city may be. If you're terrified to go around at night, it isn't much of a nightlife in my book. And there is a lot going on here, and you can virtually walk anywhere in town without looking over your shoulder all the time. In other words, a very wonderful, benign place to be at night. So what we wanted to aim at was in the same vein as the first spots, is what does it feel like here? Not so much all attractions, but what do folks do at night here? What does it feel like on the street? How sweet is it on the street at night? A little anthem to Philly at night. Now, I happen to think one reason that there was such pressure to do this was the first time around when we tested the first spots, they were tested against I Love New York commercials, which are all nightlife. And so some of the respondents said, well, you know, but where's your nightlife? We love them, but where's your nightlife? So here we are with nightlife.
You got Teddy Pendergrass to sing the theme, or as Patti LaBelle sang the first one.
He did a great job, too.
We're going to hear it in a second, but...
Oh, you have it?
Yeah,
oh,
but what were you... Were you looking for a different sound in
well,
choosing
bluesier,
him?
Quieter.
To go along with the night?
A little less... Patti's energy would be extraordinary at midnight, and some of the stuff we're looking at had, you know, some quiet charm to it, so... exactly as you'll hear it, that's the pace that we were looking for.
Well, let's give it a listen. This is Teddy Pendergrass singing Philadelphia Get to Know Us.
Help dancing to our heartbeat and singing to our song. Soon you'll be moving to our rhythm. Oh, why don't you come on, come along? Now you're caught up in the freedom. Oh, you're reaching for the sky. It's that Philadelphia spirit, that Philadelphia spirit running high. Philadelphia, get to know us. See what people who believe in the power of each other can do. If we hold hands and walk together, Philadelphia, come on, get to know us. Won't you get to know us? Then I know you never want to say goodbye. See, I know because I was raised here, Philadelphia.
Teddy Pendergrass with saxophone backing by Grover Washington. My guest is Garrett Brown, who directed the first and the new Philadelphia Get to Know Us TV spots. Well, let's talk about the shots that are in it, and then we'll talk about the issues behind the campaign.
I love doing this, describing a TV spot.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time. Here we go. Do I have to describe it as fast as it runs? No. It starts, I guess I should say what the shots are and then why they're in there, if it isn't obvious. It starts with a shot that pushes out on what looks like a wonderful penthouse balcony after a party at 3 a.m., and Grover is standing there in shirt sleeves just blowing the sax riff out over the city. It happens we shot it on Rittenhouse Square in what is not really a penthouse. We had to build, you know, the doorway and the balcony and et cetera. 23 floors. And then we shot it, in fact, during a storm, so it was quite exciting. It wasn't supposed to look like that, but it was blowing about 40 miles an hour. We had to tie Grover down to keep him from blowing away. And that dissolves into a shot which I happen to love, which is in the Philadelphia Academy of Fine Arts at midnight, one presumes, and a woman who is the cleaning lady has stopped in her rounds and is looking at a reclining nude, quite a wonderful picture, and she just is standing there with her hands on her hip, stretching slightly and looking at this painting as if it reminds her of some escapade in her youth, or she just has a particular affection, or she wishes he was out there reclining or whatever. But I wanted to look particularly at Philadelphians in the backdrop of Philadelphia. I think the people are what's fascinating about any city. You know, a commercial about Paris gets interesting to me in the inverse proportion to losing sort of the architecture and seeing eccentric Parisians by the water or in the bookstalls or et cetera. And enough of the committee felt this way that this is sort of the thrust of a lot of these shots. We then have a shot that races through the Heartthrob Cafe, which we're seeing in slow motion. 50s dancing and ending up on a couple who might be in their 50s but who are dancing very energetically and just barely see them. And we see David Brenner at Pat's steaks with his necktie made out of napkin that he's wiping his face with. And then we push on to Kevin Bacon, who is riding a convertible down South Street. And there we wanted to do a caricature of South Street, which is virtually a caricature on a weekend anymore anyway. All the ludicrous energy of that street, I wanted to, you know, put in one block. I mean, there's a camel there getting a ticket. An officer's giving a camel a ticket. And there are all kinds of busking performers, you know, on stilts, and a guy on a pogo stick and three wonderful 50s cars going down, and a fire eater and flamethrowers and searchlights and stuff. You know, it's in a second and a half, bang, South Street, all of the energy of that place. Then a shot of Teddy in a studio doing the singing the jingle. A shot at the Four Seasons Hotel of a jogger going by that wonderful statue of a jogger, and we've dressed her up in an identical jogging outfit and done her hair the same way. And I hate to admit it, but we temporarily whitened the teeth of the statue so that their grins would be identical. And she just goes by and notices that she's an exact cover for this statue. Again, as a sort of 50s Cadillac convertible goes by into the Four Seasons. Then we did a wonderful shot in the Victor Cafe of an opera singer who is simultaneously a waiter at the Victor, and it's after hours, the tables are up. And he's just singing, he's rehearsing away. A couple of all the candles from the tables are gathered together on a stool so they cast a light on his score. I mean, he and the lady in the art museum are about the concept that, you know, Philadelphians are an extraordinary bunch. We're not just, you know, your average run of folks. We're the stuff of which legends are made. We're artistic. We have spirit. We love life here. You know, you've got to have an idea about people here. I happen to think we're a very vital crowd.
So that's the message you were getting.
Yeah, in a way.
Trying to get across
so much,
that Philadelphians are
It's even after
great
hours
people.
There, you know, we've got soul, we've got heart, and we've got spirit. Then there's a great theater shot, a Liberty Bell scene in a new way, a shot at Brera Restaurant, and finally out on the Spirit of Philadelphia, the boat.
Were you supposed to be incorporating into the second campaign any lessons from the first campaign, or taking into account any of the criticisms made at the first campaign?
Well, I am actually not aware of a terribly critical attitude toward the first one. There was some people doubted, for example, whether the first one was appropriate for tourism. I happen to personally be in no doubt about that whatsoever for some of the reasons I mentioned. I think the best thing you can do is make somebody feel good about the way a place feels and about the people.
Yeah, well,
they're not going to come here to see the bricks and stones, basically, except the obligatory, you know, bring the kids once.
There was a big debate, I think, in the first one about how much to focus on historic Philadelphia, which has been traditionally what the city has conceived of as its big selling point for tourism.
Well, the debate was maybe in the early stages of the committee process, and then once they were done, I didn't hear much about that. Basically, what we did was put the historic Philadelphia as the backdrop for Philadelphians, you know.
Why didn't I know you weren't a real supporter of focusing solely on the Liberty Bell and Independence Mall, the, you know, Betsy Ross House, the historic stuff? Why didn't you want to do that?
Because I don't think in the competitive atmosphere on television among places to visit, even, you know, that we're going to succeed in attracting people here by looking at the Liberty Bell. Maybe by looking at it in a novel sort of way, as in this most recent commercial, it is. There's a carriage going by between the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, and there's quite a clever, wonderful shot that starts at night, you know, in the middle of the night on the lit-up Independence Hall that sees a carriage enter, ghostly, sort of slow-mo with a couple in it having a wonderful time. And then in dollying back, draws the inscription on the Liberty Bell into the left side of frame just as you dissolve away. And what you get a feeling for is that you can play here. You can have a wonderful time here among these icons, you know, among these artifacts that we live with that have been standing, those stones, you know, 200 years or more.
Do you think it's hurt the city to focus so much in the past on historic Philadelphia?
I think any exclusive focus on that leaves out the real reasons that people come to a place. It leaves only the school book, must see the Liberty Bell, take the kids. It leaves out the enthusiasm that one might generate for actually being here. You know, you can generate a sense of obligation or curiosity about the Liberty Bell. I haven't thought of a good way to generate the excitement, you know, of the sort that you feel maybe about San Francisco, you know. And it isn't the cable cars. It's the way folks ride them and jump on and off of them and
Tony Bennett's song.
Yeah, it's emotional, you know.
Yeah. Another
you
criticism.
You follow me, I take it. I mean, do you happen to agree with that notion?
About the cable cars?
No, about, yes, about specifically that the historical icons are less important than the way we live among them. I'm asking you specifically because I'm just curious. You know, you have a slightly Olympian relationship possibly here because you're interviewing and you're always asking other people what they think. Well, you know,
well,
what do you think?
You're trying
how
to
you
turn
like
the
them?
Tables. Well, I think that I really find myself wondering how many people really go to a place to see the historic sites. Yet I have to say that when you go past the historic sites, there's always lots of people there. So, so probably it does have some draw. Another criticism that was made at the campaign was the focus on the neighborhoods, and a lot of people felt, well, that's great. It's a real feel good for the people in the neighborhoods. But how many people who are outsiders, who you're trying to attract as tourists, will actually ever get to the neighborhoods, and do they really care? You were, I think, an advocate for putting in neighborhood shots.
Yeah.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I think your sense of a city this day and age has a lot to do with how does it feel? Does it feel threatening or does it feel comfortable? Does it feel like you have a sense of knowing it and the people, or does it feel alien to you? The neighborhoods are a part of this city and every other city, and the a sense of acquaintance with the neighborhoods and the feeling that, yeah, those are people there. They're just people like us. They're having fun. They live there. They come and go. I think sets you up to have a much better time here whether you go anywhere near that neighborhood or not. It sets you up to feel like you know us. And that feeling is vital, I think.
One issue that I know some people raised was, is it a good idea to have black children or teenagers doing double dutch rope or, you know, breakdancing or things like that? Will it scare off tourists thinking, oh, there's a lot of inner city here? And I know people raise questions
reason.
Like that when seeing the campaign, and I wonder how you reacted to that.
For the same reason exactly, I think not. I think it's important to, you know, to get a sense of knowing where you're going. You can't shuttle people into town in buses and, you know, keep the blinds drawn on the buses until you get somewhere that we happen to regard as, you know, scenic and for the tourist. I mean, a town, a city is an entity. It's an entire thing. It has its grimy outskirts and its scrubbed up insides, you know, and I like the idea of presenting the whole thing.
Well, another thing is I notice in the new spots, there's a skateboarder in Head House Square, someone on a skateboard or roller skates.
In the new one.
I think it's probably in the first one.
Yeah, that's in the long version, I think, of the, that's in the version the city trots around for their show, you know, when they take the Philly on the road to get conventions and things.
I was wondering, too, if shots like that would be construed as scaring people off, because a lot of older tourists probably don't want to be running into skateboarders or roller skaters.
I don't know. It's so easy to be tame, you know. It's so easy to be safe. And if you're safe on this medium, you're no place, you know. They're heading for the refrigerator when you're safe. They're tuning you out. They're ignoring you. They're paying no attention to you. Safe is less than safe. Safe is very dangerous if you want to make an impact. Safe is tuning out anything that could possibly be an issue. And you've got to imagine that if we did this by committee, the thrust of a committee effort is to be safe. The thrust of a committee effort is to tune out. There's always some faction that's worried about anything you can do. So I think one of the most stunningly successful things that we did was to run a committee, to have a committee in which what came out of it was not safe. What came out of it, I think, was fairly bold, you know?
Is there anything you were really dying to do that you haven't had a chance to do with the spots?
Oh, Lord,
you know, that the committee voted you down on?
No, I don't. We didn't really fail to get done anything we wanted to do. Among other things, the there are, you know, groups and cliques and so on and committees. And the group that actually was responsible for the filming was a fairly passionate group. And, you know, we happened to see quite eye to eye on most issues. And the rest of the committee, we think, had the good sense to yield on issues that we felt strongly about. So mostly what we wished to shoot is there. And mostly we're pretty pleased with it, you know, which is another amazing thing out of a committee.
Garrett Brown is my guest, and he's a cinematographer and director. He directed the Philadelphia Get to Know Us campaign spots, the first spots and the new spots, which just started being broadcast on TV. He's also the inventor of the Skycam and the Steadicam. There's been all the speculation, is it bringing in tourists or not? How do people actually measure these things? Do you have any empirical way of measuring the results of the first campaign?
They've done some testing, which is to say they put them in malls and they bring people in who they pay or give gift certificates to or whatever, and they play the film and they measure the heart rate and salivary secretions of these people and, you know, the number of times their eyelids flutter and et cetera. And the results from that kind of testing are spectacular. A sad fact is, though, that New York, for instance, spends $17 million and runs I Love New York for pay all over the place. You see it, you know, in any large tourist exit point anywhere in the country. We had no money for media like that, and Philadelphia got a lot of local airplay, some of which is seen in New York because there are stations that are end up on cable in New York. So a great many New Yorkers, city New Yorkers, have seen these spots. But our budget to run them elsewhere was minute. You know, it ran in, I think, western Pennsylvania, western New York, et cetera. Nobody in Los Angeles has seen these spots. Nobody in San Francisco. Nobody in a number of places that you might think are great places to get tourists to Philadelphia. I mean, I'd love to pitch Philly specifically to people in Los Angeles. I think Philadelphia is the antidote to Los Angeles. I think the cities are wonderfully complementary in terms of what they provide. When you've had enough L.A., you should go to Philly and vice versa, frankly.
You're a living example of that.
Yeah, I mean,
working in the film world and living in Philadelphia.
I'm one of the most well-balanced people alive because I spend time in both places.
That's a secret, huh? But are there any more empirical ways than measuring the response of shopping mall?
Not really.
Consumers?
The spots when they ran with an 800 number got a stunningly high response of phone calls from the 800 number, which is encouraging to me. But you can only get an idea. I mean, as you can tell, we think that they work, you know. I personally think they work well for the tourist purpose as well as for feeling good, because I think it's the same job. If you feel good, you want to be there, you know. But in hard numbers, it's a hard thing to prove. I wish somebody would come up with a few million bucks and let us run them here and there, you know.
So how does it get on?
Oh, they get awards too and all that jazz. But
how does it get on other stations in other cities if the city doesn't have the money to buy spots?
It doesn't.
Has it not been on in other cities?
Yeah, we have had a little money, and it has run in only the cities we could afford to run in, and it has run in New York, as I said, by the accident of getting in there on cable. But it doesn't run anywhere where we don't pay for it. It's not a public service, for example, in Los Angeles to pitch Philadelphia, as it might be construed here.
So where has it run? What cities?
It's run, I'm a little shaky on the exact numbers, but it has run in, I think, western New York and western Pennsylvania, maybe Pittsburgh. A few little markets here and there, you know, maybe Baltimore, that's about it.
You could really ask what's the point of doing it if it's not going to run anywhere.
Well, the first point in doing it was so that it would exist if we get an opportunity such as Live Aid, where it was seen by everybody in the country and a number of people in the world, which is wonderful exposure. We managed to get it done in time for that telecast that was seen by however many billion souls, and they ran it on the world feed. So that was alone justified the minute cost of making it, I would have said. And I've always thought that it was a great idea to, you know, help us here in Philly feel good about ourselves. We should. It's a lovely town. It's a town that has been bad-mouthed in the facetious way by everybody from W.C. Fields to, you know, any cheap nightclub comic in, you know, Wichita Falls, right? And part of the way you perceive yourself is in this day and age has to do with the way you feel on film, on tape, on the air, you know, the packaged version of yourself that comes back off this giant mirror that is television. And if we can contribute an aspect to that mirror image of ourselves, this commercial, that makes you feel, yeah, that's right, it's great here, blah, blah, blah. Whether it's fluff or a lie or whatever, which I don't think it is, it still helps you think, yeah, it's all right to be, you know, a Philadelphian. I like it here. I mean, I'm tired of, you know, getting looks from people all over the country, which is when I used to work all around on films, when I said I live in Philadelphia. You know, I wouldn't mind these folks having a chance to see this spot, come here, you know, because when they do visit the town, they say, this is great, I love it here. When crews come in, who I know from elsewhere and work on films in Philadelphia, and there have been 30 or so pictures done here in the last few years, and I know a lot of people on the crews because I've worked on a bunch of films, they end up almost universally saying, I love this town, I love it here, it's great, we had a great time, I love the restaurants, I love walking around, I love Society Hill, I love South Street, I love the people, love, 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 love. Well, where is that feeling in people that haven't had the opportunity to live here yet? That's one thing a commercial like this can do. And if there's any way to get the dough and let it go out and do that job, that's the real job to do. It isn't the job of telling those people that you come see the Liberty Bell, because they're going to do that when they have kids from 12 to 18. They're not going to come on their own hook to Philadelphia to see the Liberty Bell. They're going to accept a transfer here or reject the idea of being transferred here because of the way they feel about the town, maybe without a proper hearing. They're going to pick a job in Wichita Falls over a job here if they don't feel good about this town.
Did you spend a lot of time watching the campaigns for other cities and seeing how those cities were
sold?
Most
of them are atrocious. Some are quite good. New York's is extraordinarily good, although it's heavily weighted to the entertainment end of things. The New York State stuff is gorgeous. Massachusetts stuff is dreadful. Most of it is bad.
I'm trying to remember what the Massachusetts campaign is like.
Massachusetts?
Yeah.
It's I couldn't tell you the exact words, but I can give you the tone of it. The tone is sort of, basically.
You don't like it?
Not particularly, no. I mean, one studies advertising in general more than one studies city campaigns. I mean, you study how you sell Chevrolets or how you sell Frito-Lays or how you sell, you know, you name it. I mean, selling is selling. Selling is take what must be considered to be the best aspects of something, you know, without being totally dishonest about it, and making them look as absolutely bloody great as they can look. You know, that's what it is.
Well, some people sell based on research and other people do sales spots according to intuition. Which do you use for the
ones
you do?
We flew mostly by intuition here. It's hard to research. It's hard to come up with anything much more than that Philadelphia doesn't have the zingiest tourist image on the planet. Well, we knew that going in. If we happen to feel differently about it, you know, it's something else. We got a great jingle, wonderful rendition by Patty. That energized, things like that energize a project. The committee came to life once again after snoring over its box lunches when that jingle finally hit the tape recorder there, you know.
I think you've directed it in a way like a rock video.
Somewhat, yeah, yeah.
The camera's slightly moving the whole time.
Yeah, somewhat, particularly in the most recent version, yeah.
Did you use the Steadicam or your Skycam?
Oh, yeah, I tell you, I didn't use Skycam, but I used Steadicam. It's handy.
I figure that you must have in your mind, whether you care to reveal it or not, a kind of outtake version of the Get to Know Us spots, you know, the ironic, sarcastic version.
No, not actually. Strangely enough, no. No. When I do a commercial project every now and then, one is tempted to play with the outtakes and so on. I mean, this will sound really stupid, but there was a lot of genuine love and affection for the town that lit up this job. I mean, we weren't, you know, out there looking at our watches and wanting to go home. I mean, there was a great amount of affection for the place, and it developed even in all of us as we did this. I mean, I heard the jingle on the set 300 times, and I still enjoyed it down at the end. I mean, this is, you know, sounds very cornball, but there was, I think, this is the result of a genuine affection for Philly and a genuine frustration with the way it has been perceived and is still being perceived in some quarters, I imagine.
Garrett Brown is my guest, and he directed the television spots for the Philadelphia Get to Know Us campaign, the original spots and the new ones, which have just started being shown on local television stations. I know that I know a couple of people in the shots, in not the star type people, but the extras, like the scholars and the first ones. And
did you know them?
I knew one of them. But I've noticed in restaurants sometimes, as I sit there overhearing other people's conversations, that other people are talking about friends in the spots. So I figure it's the closest some of us will get to really knowing a film star. Does that happen to you all the time, that people come up and say, "Yeah, my friend blah 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 is in the spot"?
They're intrigued. They're intrigued with who and what and where is in there. We didn't want it all to be terribly obvious either. You know, we put some of the more obscure celebrity types in, as well as some of the more well-known types. There's a woman who is a chef in a restaurant called Brero's. Her name is Dasanka Giampaolo, and she's a remarkable person. She teaches cooking to disadvantaged souls and ex-convicts and so on, and they get jobs as a result because she's very good at it, and she's a spectacular chef and a very interesting face. And it was her face and the fact that I sat in that restaurant and saw an event that duplicated what we ultimately filmed, the great raucous party of souls from all nations. There was a guy who looked like he might have been the prime minister of Israel, and next to him was a bunch of Spanish ladies with their mantillas and so on. A great eclectic crowd. And they started making a ruckus to get Dasanka to come out of the kitchen. She came out of the kitchen. They stood up and gave her a big hand, and her reaction was so ingenuous to that we just enjoyed it, you know. And then later, as the spot came up, we thought, well, let's do that scene. And we went looking around for people, and she has an amazing face. And she ended up, we said, well, what the hell, let's use her, you know. Nice shot, you know.
The Ritz Theater showed the original spot as a short almost before their movies would start. How did they get to do that? Was that a request?
The theaters, Ritz and the Budco chain, volunteered to do that. The city then spent a little money to have film prints made so that they could run the spots because they look wonderful in 35. The sad ending to that tale, however, is the city did not elect to spend the money to replace those spots in a timely fashion. So as the months went by, those same poor release prints got as ragged as the come to get your popcorn trailer at the drive-in, you know, with scratches and footprints and teeth marks in them. And finally, just, I imagine, you know, were torn into shreds. So here's this great opportunity thrown out the window because the city wouldn't invest in a few bucks worth of release prints. It made me crazy to go down there and see those prints in that ragged condition, you know.
When you were shooting on location for the spots, did a lot of people gather thinking that you were doing some big new theatrical release and their favorite movie star was going to show up momentarily?
Yeah, they were always asking what movie it is. My stock answer is we're shooting Holiday on Rubber, and they will nod up and down and go away, and you know, they go away rather quickly when you sell them. No, we would tell people what we were doing. On South Street, they were particularly bemused because of this bizarre scene that was going on there, and when the camel came out of its trailer, there were, you know, great interest among the spectating crowd, you know, like, what is going on here, you know? I'd like to report that none of them batted an eyelash when the camel came out, but that's not true. They did enjoy that.
Only in Manhattan would people be totally nonplussed by that.
Well, this camel was pretty vocal. I think even in Manhattan, they would have noticed this one.
In addition to doing your advertising and directing these Philadelphia Get to Know Us spots, you're very important in the film industry, being the inventor of the Steadicam and the Skycam, and having done shooting
very
for over...
Very confused person.
...over 200 films. Do you want to direct movies? I don't think you've directed any feature-length films.
No, I would like to. We're sort of half looking for a property. I'd love to shoot a film that is of small enough scale that I could end up owning the negative, you know, sort of John Sayles-type filmmaking. I like the way he operates. I don't know if he still is able to own his own negative, but I'd like to shoot little black comedies outside the large distributor structure, you know, not have the negative pre-owned by somebody and not have horrendous interest rates and so on, you know. This may sound like a strange, way of looking at the job of directing, but the job doesn't appeal to me as a journeyman director of a, you know, of a film in the way these things are now being made. There's so much pressure from the, you know, the UA or whoever the distributor is that I don't think I would enjoy that. I don't have the credentials yet either to get enough power under those circumstances to do what I want. So,
what about rock videos? Do you have an interest in that?
None. No, I like looking at them now and then, but I get tired of them quickly. I like some of the technical innovations that are coming along as a result of them, but I wouldn't want to earn my living directing them.
What kind of technical innovations?
Oh, there's some wonderful computer animation techniques that are being fueled by the, you know, the money that is available to make these things. And, of course, everybody's has to look more spectacular than the last one. So there's some nice research and work being done there.
What's the status of the SkyCam, which is your flying remote control operated
SkyCam, strangely
camera.
Enough, was just bought by a Japanese company called Tamco. They bought the one and only SkyCam, and they bought a license to exploit SkyCam in the Far East. And they will presumably build wonderful small light SkyCams there, which we then have the exclusive chance to buy back here, and we have the rest of the world as a territory. So the SkyCam is alive and well. We went through a very bad patch when we were unable to raise the capital to build any more of them, and now the Seven Samurai have arrived with, like, the cavalry, you know, and are carrying on with it. The machine is in Japan. We may, in fact, go in November to sort of be there symbolically for the first job that they're going to do in Japan, the shooting a rugby game. So that's kind of exciting. I was kind of depressed about that because it, you know, it was a struggle for the last year or so. But now that seems to be okay.
So right now, really, nobody in America can use it because there aren't manufactured yet.
We turned down requests for it. I turned one down today from London, a film that has a shot that can only be done by SkyCam. I said, I'm sorry.
What was the shot?
There's only one. I didn't even get that far because I didn't want to waste this person's dime from London. But I told him there's only one, and it is in Tokyo as we speak.
The shots that I know of that
in pieces, probably.
Really? The shots that I know of that have been used, that have been done by the SkyCam include some sport shots and then also point-of-view flying shots like in Birdie.
The Boy Who Could Fly, we just did. There's a wonderful SkyCam sequence in that, yeah.
Has it gotten past the literal I am flying type shots?
It is such a specialized gadget. I don't know that until somebody has an opportunity to use it in a regular sort of production in a sporting event, it is what it is. It's your audience's little airplane, in effect. And for a feature, just like the Steadicam was originally used just for stunt shots running up and down the stairs. I mean, I can't tell you how many flights of steps I used to run up and down because nobody could think of anything else to do with it. The SkyCam will have to work through, you know, the perception that it's for flying shots. It isn't the word, you know, the fact that it flies doesn't mean it's for flying shots necessarily.
You've created two moving cameras that have made shots possible that were either impossible or technically so difficult that they became really expensive to do. So these kinds of shots are much easier now because of your inventions. Do you think that you've changed the language of movement now? Film movement on screen? Camera movement?
Oh, I don't know. In the sense that if you consider a camera move a verb, I've added a couple new verbs in the language, you might say. Steadicam and SkyCam and my new CheeseCam and EarthCam and SnakeCam, any cams you might think of, let you move without some. They eliminate restrictions. Let's put it that way. Most camera moves were made customarily on a dolly, which rolls along on track. And I've always been fascinated with what happens when the camera moves. I love the moving camera because it makes a two-dimensional medium seem three-dimensional. But I don't like it just to move for move's sake. I like it to move for a reason. And just with a Steadicam, you're just a little more adept at where you can move it and how fast can you decelerate. It's a human-controlled medium, and unlike a 1,000 pounds of dolly that you've got to push and stop and so on, you know, much more facile in some ways.
You were telling me before that you've been studying guitar, classical guitar, I think.
Yeah, for a year.
And that's helping you with the Steadicam movements.
It's very weird, but I'm learning things about interpreting particularly Baroque music. And my first inclination as a, you know, hacking beginning student guitar player was to go playing through these things very regularly, metronomic, bash, 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 you know, and very proud of myself that I can even get through. And that is quite a lot the way the camera is frequently moved on a dolly. I mean, you start and you roar down to your end of your tracks and you stop, you know, and there's so many generations of human between the what's actually on the screen that the operator sees and this fellow who pushes this wheeled contrivance who doesn't see what's on the screen. I believe I'm learning things about what is possible with camera moves in the emotional sense. In other words, if you play a camera move off the metronomic beat, if you lag your acceleration a little bit as you move and as you slow down at a particular rate as you approach somebody and then drift laterally and kiss it off and so on, and at the same time booming up a little bit and drifting back at an emotional moment and so on, I think that we still have things to learn about the emotional content that a camera move can give to a scene. I could shoot it in the way I'm sort of now beginning to feel, and I could shoot it in the classical old mechanistic sort of way, and you compare the two and it is absolutely no contest in terms of what is more exciting, more compelling, more interesting to watch. And it depends on, of course, what the drama is, but let's take a spy thriller or something like that. It has a tremendous impact to make on the way one feels about a scene, I think. So I think that despite the fact that the film biz is 80 or 90 years old, that we still have a lot to learn about that. And I'm currently feeling like I'm learning a little bit about it just from, you know, having my, let's say, metronomic sense, you know, expanded a little bit by learning a bit about how to interpret music. There is something musical in a curious sort of way to what you do with this thing. It's a bit like music. It's a bit like dance, you know. Dance is not like the Russian army chorus necessarily. It can also be like ballet or like interpretive dance. So either I am a culturally deprived person that's just waking up to these things, or I have discovered a miraculous new relationship in terms of the moving camera. I'd like to hope it was the latter.
Oh, everybody knew this, Garrett.
Gosh.
So this is something that is also going to affect you as a director too, because you can also work with that kind of subtlety of rhythm.
Well, I can look for it. I can certainly look for it if I
insist on it.
Imagine, yeah, I can look for it, and I can force my minions to deliver it. You know, I can be conscious of it anyway. Could all be, well, no, I think it's real.
You haven't been doing a lot of movies because you've been spending a lot of your time teaching other people to do it and working on other projects. Do you miss that at all?
I think I did my time. I mean, it got to the point if I showed up on the street to do a shot of a conventional sort, I had guys in the crew saying, "What are you doing here? I thought you were rich," quote, you know, or "I thought you, you know, didn't do this anymore," or "I heard that you broke your leg," or "I heard you were in Timbuktu," or whatever. In other words, I didn't want to show up and take work out of the away from the guys that I've been teaching to do it. And I'm happier teaching, I think, so. Unless it's an unusual shot, like the Jedi or something, then I'll pass.
What's funny about that to me is that it seems like such a coveted position. You know, who wouldn't want to be shooting a movie? Then probably when you get inside, it's kind of like, you don't have to be sticking around doing this. You can afford to not do this.
Well, at times it's great, and at times it's paralyzing. It's like, I think there's more range than the average job. I mean, the best and worst moments of my working life have been doing Steadicam shots.
Right.
Some of the best are fabulous, and the worst are you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, right. Okay. It's been great to talk with you again.
Thanks.
I thank you a lot for coming
Thanks
back
a lot.
To
nice
talk
to see
with
you.
Us. Garrett Brown has been my guest, and he's the inventor of the Skycam and the Steadicam, and has done shooting for over 200 movies, including Return of the Jedi and Rocky and The Shining. He also directed the Philadelphia Get to Know Us TV campaigns, the first one and the new one that's just starting to be broadcast on local TV stations. And he's also on the Molson's campaign. That's his voice that you hear flirting with his partner on the campaign. And your voice, I should mention, is also on one of the new Get to Know Us spots at the very end. You're giving an 800 number.
Mm-hmm.
And then your partner says, come spend the night with us. And I was wondering if that was supposed to be a sexual overture or what.
Oh, I'm just flirting with her, as I always do.
Right. Well, thanks again for being with
us. Thanks,
dear. It's 16 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in about 10 minutes, our report on the Contras. We'll hear from a former Contra and a current Contra. Philadelphia Drama Guild opened its 16th season this month with the play A Shana Madel, which is Yiddish for a pretty girl. Barbara LeBeau's drama tells the story of two Jewish sisters from Poland who are separated in childhood and reunited almost 20 years later in New York City. Rose, the younger of the two, was brought to New York by her father Mordecai when she was 4, whereas Lucia, who was too sick to travel at the time, stayed in Poland with her mother. She grew up there, lived through the Nazi concentration camps, and as the play opens, has arrived in New York as a refugee. Tova Felshu, who is in her mid-30s, plays Lucia. WHYY's arts reporter Christiane Vaillancourt spoke with her yesterday about the role and about her career.
Bowled It Over was Tova Felshu's reaction when she first read A Shana Madel. She found the play extremely powerful. That, coupled with the chance to work with Robert Kalfin again, he directed her in the title role of Yentl 10 years ago at the Walnut Street Theater, made the role of Lucia irresistible. Ideally, Felshu would have liked to have gone to Poland to study for the part, but because of lack of time, she resorted to interviews with Holocaust victims, film footage of the period, and lots of books. Felshu